Welcome to Influential She, the podcast about accelerating the influence of women in the world.
You will find us to be a fresh voice in an old conversation.
And here we are, your amazing co-hosts, Deb Soholt
and Mel Schopp. Well, welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Influential She. And this is our conversation about accelerating the influence of women in the world. I'm your co-host, Mel Schopp.
And I'm Deb Soholt. And we're just so glad that everybody is tuning in again to Influential She. So today, we're actually going to be talking about the high leverage practice of possibility. And this is about shaking up conventional wisdom. I think, Mel, you and I have talked a lot about conventional wisdom.
No kidding.
And to really unleash your imagination and innovation. And I think sometimes that always sounds like it's so tidy, you know, to try to follow something you're dreaming about. But it doesn't always come out of you're in this optimistic, happy place. Sometimes unleashing possibility comes from times when you're actually not in your best space. But it's about holding tight to your imagination, to being able to almost innovate around this situation that I'm in and saying, this isn't going to hold me down. And we're really excited about this high leverage practice of possibility because, many times you're in a situation where you almost lose your dreaming and you think, okay, well, I'm really contained by this structure, by this organization, by what people are telling me about myself. And so staying in the high leverage practice of possibility is just really about seeing something different for yourself.
You know, I remember I had this saying in my office on my desk that said, do one thing every day that scares you. And I think our next guest is just a great example of somebody who was willing to do that. So today we have with us Abby Javrick. And Abby Javrick is somebody who I truly admire just deeply. Even though she's probably half my age, she has definitely been able to shake up some things in the world through just being really brazen and brave about looking at that next possibility. So Abby, I think untraditionally I hired you, was it almost 10 years ago? I'm not sure that that's true in the Department of Education.
8 years ago.
Years ago, okay. And in a really quite untraditional sort of manner. There was just the days when I think you said it was your first Skype session. We had no idea what we were doing. And I think back on taking the chance on somebody who was very unconventional in what we would have considered to do the work that you were going to be doing in the department. Would you say that that's true?
Yeah, I think that's very true. And I think for me, it was interesting because the department was looking for new possibilities too.
It's very true.
So you folks were restructuring and entering a new world. So
Abby, just start out, and we'll probably interrupt you because you have one of the most fascinating pathways and trajectories as far as how you got to where you are today. So let's just start out today. Your official title, though, right now, tell us where you're at and what you're doing.
So my official title right now is Vice President of Educational Solutions. I work for an assessment company called NWEA, and we're in about half of the districts in the country. But I have the privilege of leading up a lot of our innovative work and really trying to turn what would be traditional testing and summative assessment for our kids on its head. And so I actually get to go out and work with states and sort of challenge assumptions about how we do education and accountability and testing and really help folks dream about a future where things can look different. And that's a whole lot of fun.
So everybody who's listening to this might think, oh, she's this long, lifelong educator. But I happen to know that's not true. So tell us where you started and how. What are some of those pieces along your pathway that have led you to this today? So let's just start there.
You know, it's really kind of interesting. I look back and there's absolutely no reason on paper that I should be where I am today or doing what I'm doing today. Most of my childhood, music was my passion. And my whole dream in life had been to actually be a good enough musician that I could play in a John Williams orchestra someday. So I would you know, I was a good student, certainly, and did lots of extracurriculars and those sorts of things. But I would practice my flute 8-10 hours a day until I could barely move. And it was hard work, but I loved it. And so it really, I think it set forth in me sort of this idea that when you're doing something that really ignites your passion, even when it's hard or when it's sucky and you're working on something that's not coming, it still doesn't really feel like work. And unfortunately for me, in high school, I developed some joint conditions during the end of my high school career. And that dream was sort of ripped away from me very unceremoniously and very quickly. And it left me with this sadness, but it also left me with a whole world of possibilities in front of me. And so I didn't know what to do. And I didn't quite know where to go. And so in the logic of a 17-year-old kid, I looked at the scholarship offer in front of me that seemed the most exotic at the time. And I said, oh, well, this is a possibility. That scholarship happened to be an aerospace engineering scholarship at Arizona State University, which felt about as different from small town South Dakota as possible. And really, like in my mind, if you have what it takes to become a rocket scientist, why not?
why not?
I mean, that is just really an example of innovating and your imagination taking you to new places.
Yeah. So it was crazy. And I look back and I have to laugh at myself, but it got me out of my comfort zone. It felt about as different from small town South Dakota, as I could find. And as I got into it, you know, I took my first few classes. I was working for NASA. I got to do some cool things. I tested satellite separation components we designed in zero gravity. What kid gets to do those things? But I also realized it was isolating and I really didn't enjoy it. And so I think I learned a pretty important lesson out of that, was that just because you can do something doesn't necessarily mean you should.
That's a really powerful statement. That's, yeah.
And so, Abby, when you were in this kind of isolating space, how long did it, you know, I mean, how long were you there before you went, oh my gosh, I'm sort of feeling that this is not it. Even though I can do this, I'm working alone. It's not, how could you then flip to thinking about a new possibility for yourself?
So it was a tough situation, right? So sort of the perfectionist in me, you know, I only halfway joke that someday my autobiography will be titled Too Stubborn to Fail. But that stubborn part of me was like, well, you just got to stick it out. But I realized, I would say probably about 12 to 18 months in, that I was miserable. The fire and that I had felt when I was looking at music and playing music was nowhere to be found. I waffled around and tried to figure out what I wanted to do. So took separate part-time jobs on the side. I was a NFL security guard for a while, and I did some missionary work for a local church. I ended up running a group home for adults with disabilities, and just trying to find something that spoke to me. And finally, I just realized, like, this was not good for me. So about 2 years in, I actually gave up a full ride scholarship and transferred schools.
Okay. I keep thinking about your mom and dad going, what in the world is she doing?
Yeah.
You're young. I mean, you're really young to be making these decisions.
Yeah. And I look back and I knew exactly what all of their arguments were going to be. And so I had actually taken the time to prepare. I had taken a notebook and I had written down every single argument my mother was going to have and what my response was to that. But I think the people around me understood that sort of that my heart and my soul weren't being fed in what I was doing, because I called my mom and talked to her about it. And she absolutely floored me. It was the one reaction I didn't expect. But she just said, you know what? You have not been happy. And I'm so proud of you for trying to figure out where you need to go. And then just cue, you know, 20-year-old Abby in stunned silence.
Wow.
No idea how to respond.
Every now and then, parents can get it right.
Series of life that happens when we're about that age. I fell in love. I transferred schools. Went from Arizona to New Mexico and kind of waffled for a while, right? I took some special education classes. I took some English classes and found myself in a situation where I was young, I was married, and I had a baby on the way. And that sort of ignited a flame under me, and I knew I needed to get a degree if I was going to take care of my kiddo and my family. And actually fell into the world of sociology, which was, I'm pretty sure, something that before I actually became a sociology major, I'm not even sure I knew what sociology was. But for me, it was, I needed to move forward. And they taught a lot of classes online. Online education was pretty new at that point in time, but it allowed me to continue to work. I was running biology and chemistry labs for a community college and working in a OBGYN clinic as a medical records clerk, and needed to do that to take care of myself. And it let me continue down and find a future and a possibility where I was going to get a degree. I wasn't going to let having a kid on the way stop me. If anything, I think it strengthened my resolve. And much to my surprise, I got into the classes and they just made sense in a way that it was kind of like, are you serious? Is this really something to study? Like just understanding the patterns in the world and how the world works and how you want to make the world better. And I fell in love with the subject and did really well in my studies, got really, really engaged. And you know, through a series of weird things, I will forever be thankful. I hit my last semester of undergrad, and I had a 1-year-old, and ended up in a situation where we didn't have daycare, and I had professors who were understanding enough to actually let me bring my kiddo to school with me. So we would get up, and I would take him to the park and run him ragged, and I'd load him up into his stroller and use the little drink tray on the top of his stroller to take notes. And I would walk back and forth in the back of the classroom and take notes so he would sleep through class the entire time. And then between classes, we'd do it again. And I ended up befriending some of the other graduate students at school. So when we'd have exams and I couldn't walk back and forth in the back of the lecture hall, they would play with him in the hallway so I could take my tests and then come out. And that was how I finished my degree. So I only kind of halfway joke that, you know, by the time my kid was 5 years old, he'd probably spent more time in a college classroom than most college sophomores have.
That's great.
Well, and just thinking about, Abby, that was possible.
Right.
You know, you said, hey, listen, it might be possible that I could bring my child. I mean, at least I could check into it and ask. You know, what does it hurt? If they say no, they say no. But I think that's correct. Part of staying in that space of possibility.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, life changes around us in ways that we can't imagine sometimes. And it's easy to, it would have been easy to be defeated, right? It would have been easy to be 21 years old with a baby on the way and saying, there's no possible way I can finish school. It would have been easy to be that 22-year-old kid and say, you know what, daycare just got taken away. I guess I can't finish my degree. But I don't know that those thoughts were ever more than maybe a fleeting thought that went through the back of my head. You know, I grew up as a young kid in, I guess you would say, poverty, right? There were times in my childhood where we lived in my grandparents' cinder block basement, right? It was essentially a root cellar, and that's what we had to do to get by. And I remember my parents just working their butts off, both in factories at that point in time in my life. And I think from a young age, what I saw and what I learned and what was impressed on me is education and hard work, we're going to open up a whole world of potentials, but nobody was going to do it for me. Right? I had to unlock the possibilities myself, but they were there. If you were willing to look, if you were willing to think creatively, and if you were willing to try to move forward. So that's kind of how I always approach life.
Okay. So you got the sociology degree though, but that's not going to like get you to be the vice president.
Yeah, some would say a sociology degree. What are you going to do with that?
That?
So, like you understand the world. How are you going to be in it?
Right. No, absolutely. So I finished my degree and figured I was going to have to pound the pavement for a job. But I had the degree and that was what was important. And the university actually came to me and they said, what are you doing? And I said, I don't know what I'm doing. And one of my professors sat down with me and said, you know, if you want to come to grad school and enroll in our master's program, we'll guarantee you a spot and we'll give you a graduate assistantship. And I thought, huh, well, that could be interesting, right? Like I could work at the university and, you know, learn some research and do some stuff. And so I thought, why not, right? Like I like what I'm studying. I like what I'm doing. Let's give it a shot. And I got into that, and the research assistantship, which was supposed to be like 15 hours a week, lasted all of 2 weeks before the university turned it into a full-time job. And so I became a researcher, and I set up mentoring programs for faculty, and I helped set up a teaching institute, teaching faculty who were beautiful researchers but who had never been in front of a classroom before how to teach, how to deal with some of those things like classroom management and assessment and curriculum in the classroom, which meant I had to go through a crash course of those things myself. So I worked on these grant programs as a researcher for the university while I finished my master's degree. I taught for the Community College of the Air Force. I taught some dual credit courses. Very non-traditional route into education and realizing, I think, just how much education meant to me. And that was very interesting. So I got my master's degree in sociology just as the grant program was winding down. And the university came back to me and they said, so we can't turn your job into a permanent paid position with the university, but we need somebody to come and learn how to be a big database programmer and coder in our institutional research office. We need somebody to do all of our federal reporting and to evaluate programs and to help us design some and run some assessments to understand student engagement and value-added measures of student learning for our undergrads. Are you game? And I thought, why not, right? I don't know how to do any of these things, but I've got a bit of an engineering background, so I'm pretty sure I can pick up the programming, and with all my sociology and research, those skills will play nicely in the rest of the world. And so I jumped in headfirst and learned about federal reporting and databases and all kinds of things that I never imagined I would be doing. And it was an adventure. It was hard. It was actually probably some of the biggest professional learning I've had to do, and I had to self-teach. There weren't people in the office who were able to do a lot of that. We were a tiny shop. And at the same time, my ex-husband, at that point in time was my husband, thought that he might want to go back to school and get a master's as well. And they had an online program in industrial engineering. And so we kind of had the conversation of sort of help him stay on top of things. Would it be good to enroll in the program together? So I went back to school, right? I used my lunch breaks and I took all my prerequisites, right? You know, differential equations and all the math that I didn't have to have in my sociology degrees. And we enrolled in a master's program in industrial engineering together.
That's really bizarre.
And it was good, right? It was kind of like coming full circle back to my engineering roots. And he realized that the job he was doing at the time was just too demanding for him to finish the coursework. But again, right, autobiography, too stubborn to fail. I said, well, that's fine. I'm going to finish. And so I continued to take classes. And as I was finishing the program, the university came to me and they said, you know, we're starting this post-master's certification in systems engineering. Will you stay and finish that and become one of our first students to do that? So that's the story of how I ended up with a second master's degree and a certification as a systems engineer. And it was kind of fun. It kind of brought lots of pieces of who I was together. And yeah, so I finished that, and I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it. We had a lot of military bases around. I thought maybe I would look for a job there.
And you were in New Mexico, right, at this time?
Yep.
Okay.
We were in New Mexico. You know, thought maybe there'd be something else in the university. And I don't know how to say it in a much nicer way, but the world just started falling apart around me. things at the university, I think politically got a little bit unstable. They went through a really rough patch, and we went through a lot of different leadership changes that made things kind of rough. It was very clear to me at that point in time, my marriage was on the rocks and it was not getting better. We had a lot of other family things that were going on. And meanwhile, I'm an only child. My parents are back in South Dakota. And back in 2011, there was some just absolutely horrible flooding in South Dakota, and they were displaced from their homes and lost nearly everything. And were trying to put their lives back together. Dad had had some health problems and strokes and had been in and out of work as a result of that. And so I really started thinking, you know, is there a possibility here that doesn't have me in New Mexico? And it was heart-wrenching. I remember actually just sitting in the parking lot before going into work and just crying because I felt so lost and didn't know what to do. And then started doing the, all right, it's time to put on your big girl panties and let's figure out how we move forward. What are the potentials and possibilities in front of you? And so really thought about the need to feel like I could be there and help my parents, and really the need to feel like I had that support system. So I started looking for jobs back in South Dakota, and everything I came across, I was way overqualified for, but didn't have experience in that particular field. And Melody, that's when you guys found me. You guys had, if I recall right, had hired a headhunting firm as part of a reorganization the department was going through.
That's exactly right. Yeah, because we, you know, we just weren't finding the type of candidate that we wanted. But again, you know, when they sent me your resume, I know there was a lot of individuals in the department just shook their heads and said, what, you know, seriously, this is not, you know, you definitely did not check the boxes. You wouldn't have been one of those that if you'd gone through the traditional online, whatever those, you know, job searches are today, they would have thrown you out right away because you know, your background did not match somebody who was going to run a teacher certification program.
So that was, it was fun and it was exciting. So I remember, like, out of the blue, I was driving home from work on a Friday. I had a screaming kid in the car seats and my phone rang and it was a South Dakota number. And because I'd been looking for jobs, I, of course, you know, pulled over to the side of the road and I picked the phone up and it was this headhunting group. And these recruiters just, they said, we want to talk to you right now. And so I visited with them, and probably because I was a little bit harried, I was maybe a little bit more authentic and honest and open than I normally would have been. And we had a beautiful conversation, and I think by the end of it, we were all laughing, and it was about a 15-minute drive home after that call. And as I was pulling in and unbuckling the kiddo from the car seat, they called back and they said, you've got a Skype interview at 7 a.m. on Monday. I'd never even used Skype before.
Right? So neither had we.
So I actually spent the weekend like calling friends and practicing, like, could I log in and could I get that? Like, did I know how to use the mechanics of it so that I was ready for that interview on Monday? And it was a comedy of errors, right? The
yes,
first time that we talked, you were having technical problems. I was having technical problems. I knew we were moving, so we had started packing. I think I had a wall of boxes behind
you
me.
Did.
The dog was running in and out of the room. And the kid was screaming in the other room. It was an adventure, but we had some really good conversations and really talked a lot about how the skills and the experiences that I had had really could come together to do the job. So we were talking about accountability systems and we were talking about assessments and we were talking about teacher licensure and certification and those things and really, I think I was able to paint the picture for you, and I was able to see how all of those pieces that I had gathered over the years, the data experience, the systems level experience, understanding sort of how the social world worked, and you know, the work I had done with faculty members and with measuring students could come together and actually create a whole person that had the skill set that you were looking for. And I think you were able to see the possibility that I painted. As well.
I mean, that's just, it's such a beautiful example of moving into a space of imagination for what is possible based on pulling together all these different skill sets. I think so many times we think we have to match the container that people are looking for versus saying, how can I translate who I am and my authenticity of who I am along with what I know, and that can be translatable into a new space. I mean, it's just exciting to see, you know, how you ended up there. And also just the possibility that I don't even know Skype. My space isn't even right. I've got a screaming kid. I got a dog. I mean, that would flap so many people to say, oh, this isn't possible. I can't make this happen. Instead, you were like, why not? Why not? I can disrupt my life, which is part of being a possibilist, is to be disruptive to yourself. Not only disruptive to maybe a system, and it's uncomfortable. Like you talked about that discomfort on that weekend, trying to figure it out.
Yeah, I think a lot of times we forget that discomfort usually means there's an opportunity to grow there. And there's an opportunity to push ourselves to be better. So the next time we hit a situation, we're not going to be so uncomfortable. We're going to have a new set of tools in our box to help us solve the challenges that are there and help us imagine a future that we hadn't even imagined. So that was kind of it. Like we had the interview and I think we had a short follow-up call, and it was mostly because Melody had other team members who wanted to see my face. and we had a good conversation, and the next thing I knew, I was getting ready to move, and that it was absolutely crazy. I'd been studying martial arts for a number of years, and we had to plan the move just right because my first shot for getting my black belt was like the Friday before I was supposed to start work, and it was a 2-day drive across the country. So like everything had to fall into place. So I tested for my black belt, drove home. We threw stuff in the car and like this whole caravan of moving trucks and boats and all kinds of stuff took off across the country. So did that and then started at work the following Monday.
And here's what I found fascinating with you, Abby, too, is that we quickly realized that there wasn't a set capacity and that you were not concerned about, and maybe you were, but we didn't keep that. You were not concerned about staying in your lane. So, you know, I think I continued to try to find, wanted to keep you challenged, but you definitely challenged us in many different ways because you evolved. So not only did you come into a position, but you evolved within the department in really unique sort of ways that, you know, I don't think any of us even imagined at that point in time, and certainly was not in the job description. I think you would come to me once in a while and said, I don't think this is in my job description, but it's like you had capacity to do it and you kept pushing us, I think, to think differently.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think about some of the things that we did. I came in and actually one of the first things that you handed me was we need to create a teacher evaluation system and we don't have a great relationship with the teachers union right now. Let's figure out how we fix that mm-hmm. and get them to create an evaluation system with us.
Yep.
It was a little scary going into that situation because I knew, like I was very aware that even though I had taught and I had done this dual credit stuff and taught at the high school level and taught at the college level, I wasn't a teacher. Yeah. And so I understood very much that clouded their perceptions of me. I was a bureaucrat coming in. And I think there was a whole lot I learned about just listening. And we had new federal plans and new federal report cards. And then we had this whole world of messy assessment, and we had to figure out how do we do new and better and bigger assessments. And Melody, you and the governor kind of came to me and they said, you know, we're part of these groups that are trying to figure out how do we collaborate and keep costs down and make better assessments. And they've asked us for recommendations. If we've got folks from the state, we'd like to help lead this and we'd like to nominate you. And it was just kind of like, all right, like let's do this. Let's figure this out and let's try to figure that out. And so there was lots of that work too. And you know, that became beautiful. That became really important work, not just in our state, but really across the country. And I think by the time I left, I had been elected by my peers across the country to higher level leadership positions in the consortia that we'd created and actually ended up as the executive chair of the board for the Smarter Balanced Assessment System. And that just really opened my eyes and gave me all kinds of skills in the world of education and assessment, and really in sort of understanding the education landscape that there's no way I would have got otherwise.
You know, though, beyond that, Abby, I think it was not just the skill. I think what it was allowed you to do is to see the possibility that you had some real leadership capability, as well as, you know, maybe it was all the sociology degrees. It was putting all those pieces together that lets you know, you know what, I have capability and ability beyond just my little lane that I'm playing in.
Well, and I think what's so, what in hearing this story, in your story, is that then the governor and Melody, they saw, because you saw possibility for yourself, and you were just like, I'm just going to roll up my sleeves, and I think this is possible, and I'm going to work hard, and I'm going to learn. Then others start to join in to see the possibilities for you too. You know, that if you, but you first have to believe something is possible to be influential as a woman. You got to believe it for yourself first. Then others capture your spirit and then start trying to be exponential with moving you on. And that's exactly what happened to you. It's such a cool story.
You know, I'm forever thankful for folks who were willing to take a gamble on someone who is very non-traditional, and someone who would bring these crazy dreams for how things could be done differently. I can't tell you how many times I'd go into Melody's office and I'd say, you know, I got this crazy idea. Just hear me out. you could almost like see her, like feel her rolling her eyes just a little bit before she'd turn around, but she would always listen and help me think through things. And more often than not, she would say, you know what, that's not such a crazy idea, right? That is a good idea. How can we make it happen? And I think really that encouragement and that belief and just finding folks who can help you continue to unlock and refine your imagination, your innovation is really important. But I think it was just as important for me to be building that spirit in my team as well. You know, so my team, I think while I was there, grew from like 12 people to 44 people as we took on new pieces of work that needed to be done and reconfigured things across the organization. And just really, like, I think about some of the things that my team was able to accomplish in that space of innovation, and it's beautiful. I'm still to this day so proud of them and all of the work that they did and just the passion that they brought for what they did, and getting to be a part of that and helping them see some of those possibilities was really important too.
So then, Abby, your national work then really opened up another possibility for you. Didn't people start to see that this role that you're in now, which really is an imagination and possibility space as like a full-time job, but weren't there people that then could see on a bigger level? That tell us a little bit about that you moved into something brand new.
So I had the opportunity to do a lot of work in the national space and interact with a lot of national education and policy leaders. And the head of the CEO of the Council of Chief State School Officers, Chris Minnick, actually realized it was time for him to move back home to Oregon. He saw, you know, potential out here for his family, and he took over NWEA, which is the assessment company that I work for now. And I don't know, Melody, if you remember, but the day the announcement was coming out, Chris actually traveled to South Dakota. Melody was working closely with him at that point in time as the president of the organization, he kind of pulled Melody and I aside and told us this news was coming out. And he looked me dead in the eye and said, "You want to move to Oregon?" And I just kind of laughed him off, right? At that point in time, I wasn't in the mental space to even imagine it. Quite frankly, I had just gone through sort of a messy, very public, small-town divorce. I was in a situation where, you know, my parents were having some health challenges and some other things, and it looked like we were going to need to be moving them in. I was in the middle of a PhD program. I had a kid who was just finishing up junior high. And on paper, none of that made sense to like even consider like packing everybody up and moving them across the country. And so, you know, I'm doing the single mom thing, trying to get through school, trying to figure that out, really engaged and loving the work that I'm doing. But all of those personal things, some, you know, changes within the structure of the department and just the structure of where I was able to go in South Dakota started to shift over time. And I think my current CEO came back, you know, once a week, once every couple of weeks for like 8 months, and just kind of kept talking to me and helping paint, I think, for me, a potential that I don't know that I ever would have considered. I love living in Oregon now. I love the work that I'm doing. But before sort of that challenge and that move, it had never even crossed my mind to live in the Pacific Northwest, quite honestly. And so what I had to do is I had to spend a lot of time imagining and thinking for myself, what would a potential future look like? What could the world look like in Oregon? And, you know, that following summer, I packed my parents and my son up, and I moved us halfway across the country into a place that nobody knew. This is kind of crazy. It had travel problems when I was supposed to come out and look for houses. So I had rented a house sight unseen. So I didn't even know what neighborhood we were in, what it looked like, or what the house looked like until the day we were meeting the realtor in the moving truck at the door. and we love it. It's a beautiful neighborhood. It's a great school. You know, my son is thriving out here. My parents now live with me, which has definitely taken some adjustments. But they've been able to retire. They're here to support my son. And I get to live in this great innovation space. I still get to work across the country and talk with leaders and policymakers and teachers and students about, you know, how do we transform systems and keep doing things that are better? And how do we really just keep moving things forward and fight for equity for our kiddos?
Okay, Abby, so I think what would be really fun is in about 10 years for us to have the same conversation and to find out where you're at and where you've landed. All the possibilities, because I don't think you're done. I know that you are making some big inroads right now at NWA, and we continue to hear about you in some of the places that I'm able to interact with people and leaders across the country. And I know your name continues to come up. So, you know, I just can't tell you how proud I am of you and know that, you know, that your story's not done.
Your possibilities are not done. Yeah. You have been an amazing guest, Abby, and we can't thank you enough for being on this podcast of Influential She. For all of you listening, I want to leave you with, Melody and I want to leave you with a question that really circles back to something that Abby said. She talked about stubbornness, too stubborn to fail, but also stubbornness that you have to stick it out. So for all of you listening, what possibility is there for you to think about? Are you sticking it out and not imagining and dreaming for yourself about the next possibility? Or are you just a person that's stubborn enough to not fail and to believe in all the possibilities ahead? We thank you all for tuning in to another episode of Influential She. We hope you'll do it again.
Thanks for tuning in. If you enjoyed our podcast, we'd be so jazzed if you rate us on whatever app you use to find us. And hey, be sure to tell all your friends about Influential She.
And please visit us at InfluentialShe.com and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, LinkedIn. And you know what? If you come up with a new one, please let us know. In the meantime, remember, stay influential.